it would, I think, honourable members, maybe you do not understand that I take the time, remember I do the introduction. So that eats into the candidate's time. So I only start from the moment the candidate speaks. Could we all agree that when the candidate, because I do the introduction and that then takes the candidate's time, sometimes I'm long, sometimes I'm short. So depending on how handsome you are, I enjoy in interviewing you. So that's just to make you feel comfortable. Please, that's not sexual harassment. That is just to make you feel comfortable and to relax. Mr. Smith, you may take off your mask if you feel comfortable with that. We are interviewing for the Critical Infrastructure Council. We have 20 candidates that we have shortlisted. Of the 20, 10 will be nominated, and then the 10 names will be sent to the minister. What then happens is that those who were shortlisted, the 20, they have gone through the first stage of vetting. Once we have done the first stage of vetting and we have done the interviews, we are on recess now, so these members came back from their recess. Parliament resumes in August. We will then send those names and the minister appoints 5. So out of the 20 who were interviewed, 5 will eventually be appointed. So welcome to the interviews. I am Tina Jumat-Peterson. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Police. To my left is Mr. Gershon Dixon. Mobisutu Sahau, they are administrative staff. And to my right, we have the honourable members of the panel. They are all members of the Portfolio Committee on Police. I will now give them an opportunity to introduce themselves.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Zandile Machozi from the Inkatha Freedom Party.
Good morning. And my name is Patricia Senemis Peacock from the African National Congress.
Good morning, Mr. Smith. My name is Honorable Linda Moss. I'm from the African National Congress.
Goeiemôre, Mr. Smith. My name is Oker de Blaans and ek is van die DA.
Morning, Mr. Smith. I am Henry Andres Shambeni from the Economic Freedom Fighters.
Good morning, Mr. Smith. My name is Kenneth Mishra from the ACDP.
Good morning, sir. I'm Ahmed Manzoor Sheikh Imam from the National Freedom Party.
Honorable member, just so that we do not have any confusion, because everybody is challenging me on my phone. I'm getting messages that I'm inconsistent with the time. So because we do our introductions and we cannot eat into the time of the candidate, and I also introduce the interview, so it cannot eat into the candidate, because that then unfairly prejudices the candidate. Sometimes we're long, sometimes we're short, and that should not disadvantage the candidate. So it is 11:37, your 1 hour starts.
Good morning, Honourable Chair.
No, I did not give you a chance to ask your question. I'm the one who asked the question.
My apologies, ma'am.
No, I cannot Afrikaans praat hoor. So, welcome. Could you very briefly explain to us why you think you're the most suitable candidate for the job, your experience, your qualifications, and whatever you would like to tell us. Remember, you have an hour, and if you have long answers, it eats into your time for the next questions which may be asked. So again, welcome. This is not judges, it's a panel. We don't judge, we evaluate. Thank you very much.
Um, Thank you, Honourable Chair, committee members. I think everybody knows my name by now. I think I will start off with the most recent history of my activities for the past 14 years. I have been extensively involved at the Nuclear Energy Corporation in Kalandrava. I've conducted training for the institution in the security environment, as well as compiling procedures, policy documents, and assisting with the categorization of the various critical infrastructures in that complex. I hold a BTEC degree. I'm currently busy with my master's degree. The theme of the master's degree is concerns the training curriculum for the National Key Point Officers. As we probably all know, that act was promulgated in 1980, and some of the content of that is quite old, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why we're sitting here today, is to contemplate how we go forward once the new act comes into effect. There has been many changes in the legislative environment since 1980. We've had a new constitution. We've also have had the advent of the NQF Act, the National Qualifications Framework Act, the CERA Act, as well as many others that has actually had a profound effect on the way we look at the national key points and we conduct training and security at those key points. Now, the challenge that we have is that some of those things are outdated and some are not. And looking at what is the actual requirement, or what could possibly be the requirement for the future in terms of safeguarding such a critical facility, that is one of the things that has always been fascinating to me. I have seen what's been done in other countries at their nuclear facilities. And, you know, I've come to the conclusion that there's a credible room for improvement. But in order to make any recommendations, one has to do a research and empirical study on that. And that is really the crux of my dissertation. Prior to that period in my life, I was a business manager. I had a number of small enterprises. My business partner, who was also my wife, passed away in 2009. And I had to change direction radically. And I moved from the business environment to the education, training, and skills development environment, as well as utilizing the skills that I've had from the business environment and helping with the planning, developing procedures, and so forth at the critical infrastructure, or the old national key point, as we would want to call it. As you're probably aware, that the national key point, that particular national key point, has international commitments, amongst others the Kalandrava Accord, and there's also licensing from the International Atomic Energy Agency that we have to take into account. So there's a whole lot happening, and it's a very, I would say, it's probably one of the most complex national key points that exists, because of all the facets and all the nuances in that key point. And I don't know if I can, maybe that's a summary, and maybe Chair, if you're happy with that, then I'm open to any questions.
That's sufficient. Honorable Pico.
Thank you, Chair. What is your understanding of critical infrastructure, and why is it important for critical infrastructure in our country to be protected?
Well, first of all, we have to look at the constitutional mandate that the government has to ensure the safety and protection of everyone. And in that respect, protecting the environment, protecting the people of the country, as well as the critical buildings, facilities, for instance, transport, to make sure that those things are available and can be available for the greater good of the country. So that's, I think, the whole thing about critical infrastructure is to ensure that we have responsible governance on this matter. Why is it critical? Well, that's one of the definitions we look at. The real question there is, if something should happen to this particular installation or institution, how will it affect the country? Can we go forward? Let's take an example of our airports. If for some reason, and we've seen this with COVID, the airport shuts down, it was a major disaster in terms of economic effect. Not that, and this was not a threat actor that was acting, this was nature that was doing this. Well, we hope it wasn't a threat actor. So that is my understanding of the critical infrastructure, is to ensure that we will have those things available to the country that it requires. And this goes on. It is something that perpetuates into the future as well. We have to make sure that whatever follows in our footsteps has something to build on and something to develop. You might recall that, you know, installations like ESCOM and ISCOR was founded many, many years ago, really just for that particular reason, is to ensure that there's growth and economic development in the country. So those are, I think, the vital parts of the bloodline of this country. Without power, we're stuck. As we can see with the current situation, it has a major negative effect on the economy as well as on the morale of the people. Chair?
Honourable Peacock?
Follow-up question. What do you think is the overall intention of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act?
And let me just make sure I understood the question. What is the role of the...
Can I repeat that?
Please repeat.
What do you think is the overall intention of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act?
I think it's quite simple to make sure that we have adequate security, and we've seen on the current 2019 Act to protect buildings, people, which is something new. It wasn't in the old Act. Installations and all services, to ensure that we have a continuous availability of those services and installations for the country's economic development, as well as the stability of the country and the people in the country.
Thank you, honourable members. Any follow-up question? The next question, honourable Meshu, you have a follow-up. You may ask a question.
Sir, I'm sure you've been on this property a number of times, and you said critical infrastructure is very important to secure the people and the buildings. Now, as you've been here a few times, what is your personal perception about security in this environment where you are right now?
Chair, I think, let me just see if I understand the correction. The environment I'm right now is in the Parliament building, and you're asking me basically how I deem the security to be here. And I don't really have a very favorable view of that. the searching wasn't done as I supposed. I could have brought a weapon in if I wanted to. The escorting, I was left alone for some period of time. And although there are cameras in the foyer, you know, if I had ill intention, I could have done something. So I don't know what the rest of the security is like, the insider threat and the vetting and everything else. But I think the frontline security, I saw a few police officers that were armed, but I didn't see any armed guards. If there was really somebody out there, a threat actor, that had ill intent, it would not be very difficult to cause damage here. And that's my take on this matter.
Thank you very much. Honourable Shimbeni, you have the next opportunity for a question.
Thank you, Chair. According to you, the types of infrastructure, so critical infrastructure, what do we mean about that? If you can give me an example of the types of critical infrastructure. Just give me two. The ones that maybe need security in such a way that no photos can be taken on that area, and the one that maybe is open to photos, but it's a critical infrastructure. In other words, I want to know whether a public is allowed into critical infrastructure, and are they allowed to take photos in this, in those areas? Now, when you give me the answer, you will give me the answer to say, in those areas they can take photos, but this is a critical infrastructure. But here is a critical infrastructure and they cannot take photos. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, I think the question really revolves around the definition of this particular issue of taking photographs, and the Act states that things that are on public view and public domain wouldn't pose a problem, but specific security arrangements and such as control rooms, documentation relating to staffing and things like that would obviously not be something that one would to disseminate. So the short answer is, I think the basic things that are in public view and is in the public domain should not present a problem unless there has been a ruling on this in terms of making that information not available in terms of our constitutional dispensation. But that will be the ordinary take on this. Anything else, specific security measures, would obviously not be not be allowed. Armories, as I said, control rooms, camera installations, and even IT server rooms and such forth, because these all form part of critical elements in our critical infrastructure.
Thank you very much. Honorable Shembeni, oh, do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Could we now take Honorable Sheikh Imam?
Thank you, Chairperson. What do you believe is the role of the police and security agencies with respect to critical infrastructure?
Chair, the police has the constitutional mandate found in Section 205 of the Constitution, which also means they have to protect the inhabitants of the country as well as the state assets and ensure stability in the country. I think it's, in my experience in the past 14 years, it's unrealistic to expect the police to do all the protection work at critical infrastructure installations. There are very specialized aspects. Police are trained for general law enforcement. And although there might be a specific highly trained units, such as the VIP protection unit, the general police officer on the street is very ill-equipped to safeguard the critical infrastructures. They do not have SWAT training. They often don't understand the particular environment. If you take, for example, if it's a chemical plant, there are very specific things that needs to be taken into account when you safeguard a chemical plant. So for that reason, I think the Act also provides, Act number 8, that institutions like that, where it's state-owned, will have to do their own protection, and they will have to train their own people with regards to this specific requirement. So that's a prudent and meaningful approach on this whole matter. So anything that is deemed a armed organization in terms of Section 199 of the Constitution, which could include the police, but other institutions as armed institutions, those people will have to be trained specifically for this task, and I think that's also one of the reasons why my dissertation and focusing on this area, that selection, training, and continuous training. Yes, the police does play a role. We have special task force that can react in major crises, but we know that that's only the exception, not the rule. And we can't misuse a resource like that. So I trust that that's a sufficient answer.
Thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up? Any follow-up? Honorable Sheikh Imam?
Yeah, thank you. What about the role of the other institutions, like like the defense force, the state security intelligence.
Chair, let me elaborate. The SSA is responsible for information security, and that's their domain. It's hardly the guns and bullets type of area. The Defence Force has a mandate to operate external to our borders, to defend the borders of the country against an external threat. As we've seen in extreme circumstances, the Defence Force can be used as a force multiplier or to supplement the role. But I come back to my original contention that neither the Defence Force nor the general police officers are really equipped to deal with the specifics of high level. I'm talking now the Category 3 type critical infrastructures. I suppose a normal post office and the lower categories, that wouldn't be too much of an issue because there's really nothing there that can harm anyone. It's their question of ensuring that the show goes on and the train runs on time and nobody runs off with all the railway lines. But again, there, you know, you have to look at the specific environment and the threat. And this is very, very important. I think it's often overlooked, the whole question about what is the threat. And the threat in this case is always a human being that has some ill intent. And the Act provides for ensuring that there's no sabotage or damage to people or property. And in that respect, for the low-level things, I think probably, yes, the police officers can manage, but not the high-level environments.
Thank you very much. Honorable, I do not see any. You don't have any follow-ups? You're all happy? Honorable Sheikh Imam, would you come in?
Yes, I think you understand what is happening in the country and world right?
I think you understand what's happening in the country at the moment and worldwide. Particularly with collusion, corruption, and the challenges thereof. Have you ever been criminally charged and or convicted, or had serious allegations leveled against you for corruption, fraud, theft? Have you ever been brought before disciplinary hearing for either of the above, or gross insubordination, absenteeism, dereliction of duty, etc.?
Chair, to that question, absolutely not. I've been always been a pretty good boy. I'm probably too afraid to do anything bad. No, my moral convictions, you know, I think one has to look at life, and you have to ask yourself, what is life about? And for me, life is about being the best person I can be. It's not short-term gains, and I've always been adverse to doing things that I feel is morally unjustifiable. And that's really been my guideline and my moral compass. So, no, I have not been charged. I have not been in disciplinaries. I've avoided trouble like the plague. And I sleep easy at night. I can wake up in the morning and look in the mirror, and I'm not worried about who's going to knock on the door.
Thank you very much. Honorable Majosi.
Thank you, Chair. In your opinion, what are the key challenges facing the Council, and what role should the Council play in strengthening critical infrastructure?
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, the Council is going to be very, very busy in the next couple of years. We have a whole number of key points that has to be migrated from the old key point environment. The role and the function of the Council is to look at those applications, to help with the categorization, to help with policies and procedures. In this particular regard, I think they can play a significant and important role. So the Council is going to be very busy. It's going to require a lot of expertise in order to do this. So there's going to be a learning curve as well. And that's why I think it's quite important that we have people that has been in the environment and in the particular industry that can give their inputs to it. that it's not going to be an easy thing. It's a very ambitious act if we look at the total scope of it. It wants to protect against natural disasters and things like that as well. So it's quite an ambitious act, and we are waiting for the regulations. We don't know what these are going to entail and how they will look. So a lot of this is still mystery in the future. So for now, the basic functions of the council, I think once we start seeing those applications coming in, it's going to be crunch time. It's going to be very, very, very difficult and very busy. I'm not sure how that's going to be managed, but that's fortunately not my problem. I'll only be there to assist, hopefully.
Yes, I do, Chair. So you say maybe applications would be one of the key challenges of the council, and in your opinion, as I said before, what would be what would be the council role in making sure that you strengthen in the applications and the applications that you'll be getting? In making sure that you identify whether these are the critical infrastructure or this is not. So what expertise will you be bringing in making sure in the council in making sure that you strengthen those critical infrastructure?
Chair, I think the role I can play here is I can certainly help with the policies, procedures. I can certainly assist with the categorization. I have a very good understanding of the security environment. I've been working in this environment for a long time, especially at high level threats. So I think again at the high levels, I can bring expertise to the table, and in that regard the committee is going to be a new committee, although I suppose some of the members has already been in a position where they can or has been liaising with police. I have been the chairperson of the Community Policing Forum at Heartpeace for 11 years, so I've had some experience in dealing with the hierarchy of the police. And I think that liaison is also quite important, because at the end of the day, the National Commission is tasked with doing the bulk of the footwork in this particular case and making sure that things are going the way it's supposed to go. The committee is really an oversight and is a committee that also assists in making sure that things are running smoothly, and for that reason the committee would need as much expertise as they can possibly get in this regard.
Thank you. Honourable Meshu, you have a follow-up?
Chairperson, when answering my question about security in this place, you are not very positive. Now, what would you suggest has to be done to strengthen this critical infrastructure?
Chairperson, of course, my observation is just a superficial one. One would have to look at from the beginning. If you have to do a complete review of the security, you have to start off with the potential threats. What are we protecting? What are the undesirable consequences, and what steps do we need to put in place? Now, security normally has things that they call deterrence and delays and detection systems and some reaction capability. Now, I don't know what the reaction capability here is. I haven't seen it. But I think the fact that one could just slip in by the door, that the monitors at the X-ray machines were not being monitored, that in itself tells me that there's either a lack of proper procedures or lack of proper discipline. In both cases, and I don't want to criticize anybody, it's very easy from an outsider to come in and look at this and say, listen, this is wrong. But I think you've asked me a very specific question. What would I do different? First of all, the doors are just one door, and you can move through that door once it's open, and a lot of people can move through there. There should or could be potentially turnstiles to make sure that only one person with an access card can come in. I have nothing on me at the moment to show that I've actually been authorized to be here. I have no badge or anything. So if I'm stopped in the hallway, nobody knows who I am or what I'm doing here, whether I'm authorized or not. So those are some of the basic things that you could consider. Of course, as I said, one has to take a holistic view and do a whole review if one wants to do that. Maybe the threat isn't as big as excuse me, as what I might perceive. But I think everybody in this committee is an important person because it's the Portfolio Committee for Policing and they play a significant role. So harm to that committee could harm the country. So yes, just the access control is already not very good. The screening, the searching, there are no metal detectors there. The X-ray machine wasn't banned. And in fact, I didn't even put my briefcase through that machine. I just walked through the door. And this was not of any ill intent. It was just, there was nobody there. The guard was sitting chatting to someone else behind another door. So I think that's where we can start to sharpen things up. I come back to the deterrence. If an adversary sees that you appear to be well jacked up and your security appears to be good, that in itself already forms your first layer of defense. If the security is slack in a place, that paints the picture that, you know, I can take a chance here. And that's, I think, in a parliament, that is the key of the country. That's where the whole management structure of the country sits. Although they are in recess at the moment, but there are still parliamentarians here. And it's a very significant building.
Unfortunately, Mr. Smith, I agree with you. There isn't a single candidate who arrived here with a tag which says visitor. Not a single, since yesterday. I was looking at all the candidates who came for interviews. And not long ago in Parliament, if you were a visitor, you would have had a tag which said visitor. And as a Portfolio Committee of Police, without police protecting this building, it's a serious indictment and embarrassment for us. Anyway, Honourable de Blanche, you may ask your question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Smith, I'm not sure whether I should run for cover now or, you know, I'm considering my options at the moment. No, that is just on a lighter note. Anyway, Mr. Smith, you covered quite a bit of ground already. I am going to be more specific. Name the key strengths from a technical and leadership perspective which you will bring to the CIC if you are appointed, and what do you think are your areas of growth? What do you think you still need to make a success of such an environment, if appointed? Thank you.
Chairperson, I come with a variety of skill sets. One goes through life and you accumulate these things. I believe I have good leadership skills. I've had my share of failures and I've had my share of successes. In each of those you learn your lessons. I'm a logical reasoning person. I'm meticulous. I'm particular about things, especially detail. I have a great understanding of the environment that we are working in and the difficulties we are facing. So I think in that respect, it's a question of making sailing upwind, making difficult things, finding solutions to difficult tasks, being creative, and those are some of the skill sets I can bring in. Of course, I believe that I have had the experience in the environment and in the industry, especially at the higher levels, where I can compile procedures and policy documents where need be. Of course, I suppose I can't do it all by myself, but I certainly can make a certain contribution in that respect. As to what. It requires a clear thinking as well. You know, there are two schools of thinking and reasoning, and it's typically the deductive and inductive reasoning. And most people, if I was to say, throw the word out there, drones, you know, most people say, oh, drones is a problem, it's a threat, you know, immediately. So there's where the clear thinking comes into it. The drones are not a threat. They could maybe be used by a threat actor as a pathway in the physical domain of security. But by themselves, they can't do a thing. You know, and that's just an inert object. Like any other tool, it can be misused. And those concepts, in order to rationalize and see what is the actual issue, what are we really dealing with, and how to solve that problem, that will allow us to get past this. I have a broad background in the legislative environment, and I understand how some of the acts actually interact. The old National Key Point Act, the interaction between that, the Criminal Procedure Act, the Constitution, as well as in the training environment. And this is very important that we understand that when we do something, it's like throwing a pebble into a pond. There's going to be a ripple effect. And one has to understand what that potential outcomes could be. And one has to reason through that. And in order to do that in a logical and sensible way, you have to have an understanding of the total environment, the total landscape we're dealing with.
Thank you very much. Would you like a follow-up?
Yes, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honorable de Blanche.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Smith, you are obviously a very experienced man in your field. Let's assume for a while, from your perspective, that you are going to be appointed. What technology available elsewhere in the world at the moment will you think to introduce in this specific environment if you are successful? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The technology that is available in South Africa for security is quite varied. Anything from facial recognition to biometric readers and so forth, some of these things are problematic. I think one would have to take the view, when you look at technology as one of the security measures, that it's got to be effective. What I mean by effective, it's pointless that we have a biometric reader that works 8 out of 10 times, and because of that people simply circumvent it as an access control measure. So the technology has to be effective wherever we use it, whether it's biometric readers, whether it's facial recognition. There's wonderful technology available for surveillance purposes. There's good software available to try and pick out suspicious behavior in people. But I think most of these things are in use at some place or another. What we really should be focusing on is making sure that those things, that technology that is there, is actually suited to the task and working correctly and effective in the application. And that requires, again, coming back to training, it requires a lot of training to make sure the technology works. Case in point, you know, this morning you had some problems with the audio technology, and it was resolved. But I think technology is just a tool, and we can't really look at technology to solve our problems. It's just a tool in our toolbox to assist us to solve security-related problems. Yes, computer databases and such things are very, very handy to have. They're time-saving devices. But, you know, security has been around since the advent of mankind, and the technology available in those days were pretty rudimentary, and yet it was effective. And that, I think, is the bottom line. Whatever we do must be effective, not only in its application but also in its cost.
Thank you very much. I don't see any further hands. Honorable Sheikh Imam, you may ask your question now.
Do you have that question?
Honorable Majozi would like to come in before you come in, Sheikh Imam.
Thank you, Chair. It's a follow-up on Honorable Terre Blanche question. But what I think maybe he was more specific, what specific security that you think we need in South Africa to make sure that we protect our infrastructure and going forward to make sure that, especially in the ICT sector, to make sure that we protect also our information so that it's not hacked by other people and not out there to be accessed by the public.
Chairperson, we have already document the minimum, the MIS policy document on security of information, and that is the domain of the State Security Agency. They recommend certain procedures in that as how to deal with technology and the access to information, which is that's really what they're doing. It's not only electronic information, could be in documentary form as well. And documentary form, obviously, this is all comes down to policies and procedures, whether we take our little stiffy drive and go into a computer and download things or not. We've had a security breach at Denel a while ago when missile technology was apparently stolen, and it was a big security breach, big damage to the country. So yes, the policies, I don't think one can say that you have to have a universal technology. The environment is too diverse. If we look at a place like, let's say, a hospital, access control to a hospital, there are patients coming in and out, doctors, emergencies, and we can't compare that to the site that I'm familiar with, where we have a nuclear facility. It's completely different, and I think that technology there has to be adapted to the environment as well. What is effective in that place? What will protect what we need to protect? What will prevent the harm that we want, want to protect? And as I said earlier, technology, and I think this is also a misconception about technology, we talk about cyber environment. Cyber is just another domain. It is not information security. Cyber is just a pathway to access things. It could be a physical pathway to a safe control room, or whatever the case may be, an individual, and cyber in that respect is just another method of getting there. But cyber is something completely standalone from information security, which is could be things stored on a computer, information, or in physical printed form. So there is a big distinction there. Why did this thing happen at Denel? Well, there was the major insider threat part, and this is something that we deal with every day on an ongoing basis, and even that people are vetted, there's no guarantee that they will not do bad things and harm the country. And I think that's one of our biggest challenges. If I was to have a little magic wand, I would say that we could have maybe something that is a foolproof way of vetting people, but I don't think that exists at the moment.
Before I allow the next person to ask a question, would you consider yourself a technocrat or a member of the Critical Infrastructure Council?
Well, Chair, that's quite a difficult question. I think I would say that I would, well, technocrat, not really. I have a lot of technical skills, but that's not my forte. I think the fact that I'm quite flexible is really one of my strengths that I can bring to the council, and I can speak on authority on a number of areas.
So, because there's a fine line between being an official and being a member of council. So you'll be a member of council and not an official.
But at the moment, the task, as I see it in the Act, I think I can fulfill not all of them, but some of them, certainly. There are certain areas that's outside my specific expertise. But as a member of the council, I think I can play a significant role there. I'm not an administrator. I don't particularly like routine tasks.
Thank you. Honorable Sheikh Imam?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I think Mr. Smith had actually responded to that, the question on ethics that I have put forward earlier on. My only other question then will be, you seem to have done and continue to do your own business. How will it impact if you are appointed onto this particular council, the Critical Infrastructure Council, and you will have other business interests, if you still have them, because it's not really clear if you still have them or not. Yeah, I think that. But I think the issue of the ethics, you have responded that you've never been charged or found guilty or there were no allegations. Thank you.
Chair, at the moment, I don't have any. I still have a training organisation, but I have no commitments at the moment. My last contract ended in March, so.
Recording stopped.
Apologies for the interruption.
Shall I continue? So no, I don't have any commitments. I'm one of those people that are workless at the moment. I trust that answers the question.
Thank you very much, Honorable Moss.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Stakeholders relationships. Managing key stakeholders relationship is an important responsibility of the CIC. At times, stakeholders can be very demanding. Describe how you manage unreasonable stakeholders' expectations.
Thank you, Chair. When we deal with people, it's very important that we have to have good people skills. Listening, understanding the issues. People don't always communicate what they actually mean. We live in a multicultural, diverse environment where language skills are often also lacking. So I think one has to be, you have to probe. You have to understand what it is that the other party wants. You have to be able to deal with that frustration. And at the end of the day, we are trying to do the right thing. And that, I think that's very important that we can convey that message to say, listen, we're not on the opposing ends of the table here. We are a team. We want to resolve this matter, whatever it might be. Help me resolve it. Let's understand the difficulties, the challenge that you're having, and I will see what I can do from my side in order to resolve that. So it's a question of meeting the other person, dealing with the individual, or the group of individuals or the stakeholders. People all have their needs, and they would jump up and down and scream that they need to be heard. And that often is what they want. They want to be heard, and once you've heard them and you clarify that what it is that they want, then it might be not such an insurmountable problem that, or barrier that we have to pass through. Yes, we have very different cultures, we have different expectations about things, and one has to be sensitive to those. Good people skills, I think at the end of the day, especially working in a multicultural environment, is essential.
Thank you very much. Honorable Meshu, you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Chairperson. When these stakeholders are making demands that you know are in conflict with your values and your ethics, personal ethics, and then you realize that one or two members of the council agrees with the demands of the stakeholders, how are you going to deal with a situation like that?
Right, so we're stuck with a bit of the ethical dilemma where there's loyalties on either side, and I think the best way to resolve that is through dialogue. Yes, we do have guidelines, and we always have to go back to the book to say, what does the Act require from us? What does the regulations require from us? But those documents can only cover certain things. When we're dealing with such demands as one could try and surmise, then it's a question of sitting down with the individuals, and first of all, we have to speak in a common, from a common platform. As individuals, we may all have our own opinions about a thing, but when we depart in a council, then once we go onto a policy, then everybody's going to be on board. And that's, I think, what we call a democracy. You know, it's a question of getting people on board, making sure that we have the support of that council to go forward. The fact that one or two members might have a different viewpoint, as long as it's not destructing or verbalized and giving the wrong impression, then it shouldn't be a problem. We're all entitled to our opinions. Dealing with demands, people are often frustrated when they make those demands. And first of all, we have to try and dissipate that energy to see, let's take that energy. Why are we this upset? What is it that has caused this problem? And understanding the root cause of this problem, and then we can try and resolve it. There will be areas of conflict, and that is for sure. You know, having dealt with the police for a number of years, they have their way of thinking. And once you start understanding how a person thinks and what is the police culture, then we can see how we can meet them and where we can meet them. And it's often a question of saying, look, as I said earlier, we're not on opposition. We're here to assist each other. The council is there to play a specific role in facilitating a transition from the old to the new and to make sure that the new is successful. And if that is the common goal, then already we have something in common that we can leverage from and go forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Are there any questions you'd like to ask us?
Chair, no, not really any questions. I'd just like to thank the council for the confidence and the opportunity to be here. It's been quite an experience. It's my first visit to the parliament, and it's been awesome. So, no, I mean, it's really just been great, and thank you very much. I really hope that I can, in the future, work together, and that I can play a role. I believe I can play a role, and I would very much like to play that role. Thank you, ma'am.
Once again, thank you very much for availing yourself for the interview. Take a seat for yourself. Thank you.